It's Monday, April 30th, 2018, and welcome to episode 211 of Tech Talk for Teachers. I'm Tom Grissom.
And I'm Brian Poulter.
Welcome to Tech Talk for Teachers, a show about teaching and learning with technology. And it's the last day of the month here in April, so it's time for another Tech Talk for Teachers podcast. And been a very, very busy month. This is our last week. In fact, right now today is finals week.
Hooray!
Hooray for finals. So we're wrapping up a semester here, so it's been quite busy. Earlier this month, the beginning of this month, we went through our teacher education program here, went through our accreditation visit with the Council for Accreditation Teacher Education. So we've been through that process, kind of a self-reflecting process out there. And then a lot of things that have been on my mind lately, and a lot of things in the news with Facebook news and Fox News, MSNBC, the White House Correspondents' Dinner was just this last weekend. So we thought we'd talk a little bit today about fake news.
It's a big subject, but we'll tackle it.
All right. So we'll go ahead and talk a little bit, and we'll provide some resources. So be sure to check our show notes out there, and we'll go ahead and begin. So here we go. Up first today, we have a segment, a topic that's in the news, kind of been in the news for quite a while, and it's something that I think education needs to tackle and provide some resources and things. So that's what we're going to do today. We have Brian Poulter, one of our journalism professors here, so we've got the perfect guy to talk about this.
Collectively, your audience just went, not that guy again.
That guy again. But just coming off, we're at the end of April here, and this wasn't planned this way at all, but kind of ties in with a lot of things that we have going on in the news. And we're just coming off this weekend of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We'll try not getting too political and things in here, but that's kind of a classic example of, the two sides going back and forth at each other. So let's start with, what is fake news?
Well, so actually, we're talking about something I'm qualified to talk about, I think, for once, because I actually teach a class called Journalism and Democracy, and I'm also teaching a senior seminar called Media and Society. And we talk about this a lot in both classes, well before the idea of fake news was, that term was coined and became popular. One of the challenges I think that people or educators have when they decide to go after this topic is they're afraid that someone's going to accuse them of information bias or backing side A or side B. And that's actually not that too hard to avoid, as long as you realize what we're basically teaching is something that we've been required to teach, I think, for a long, long time, which is critical thinking and critical listening. Mm-hmm. So as long as you get examples that come from a wide spectrum of opinions and examples and all that, I think you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. But I think you're going to, in your show notes, link to a couple of these stories.
Yeah, we've got some great resources you provided here.
But so, one of the stories talked about how they did a study and middle school and high school, and from my experience, even college students struggle to look at information, to listen to information, to read information, and they fail to detect obviously mm-hmm. bad sources or get infotainment and journalism and opinion.
And advertising.
And advertising. And even, in your basic newspaper, there is a news section and there's an opinion section. And they're labeled. Mm-hmm. Our student daily newspaper, the OAC News, we have, it's just like a newspaper. And even our students go, well, they're biased. And I'll say, why? And they'll say, well, this person said that. And I say, that's a column. That is that person's opinion.
Right.
It's on the editorial page, which has a huge logo that says opinion on it.
Right.
Now, what has gotten worse in more recent years is news programs and news networks like Fox and MSNBC. They're both guilty of this. They're on both sides of the spectrum as a journalism professor. They don't label commentary and news separately. It's really confusing. Are they presenting news mm-hmm. or fact? Or they'll bring on traditional journalists in a panel.
Or a full of pundits.
And then a bunch of pundits. And these opinion leaders, I would call it a newspaper columnist, are expressing an opinion. But then you take the traditional journalists who are supposed to be neutral, but you put them and ask them to present their opinion, and it sort of erodes their credibility mm-hmm. as neutral
yeah.
think so. It's hard, and therefore, I think as journalists, but more importantly, educators, we're required to teach the reader, or in this case, our students, to be smart enough to tell the difference. And the Founding Fathers created the First Amendment because they said, let the people figure it out. We shouldn't tell them what to think. But we also have to, as a society and as an educator, give them the tools to be able to pull that off.
Yeah, and again, on our founding principles and things, our democracy requires an educated public. And, you know, as you say, we as educators can't shy away from that duty. Here in our teacher education program, John Dewey's one of the famous educators that we like to hold up. He's written several in the early 1900s. He wrote the book Democracy in Education. And, you know, it's a responsibility of citizenship to become informed citizens and things. That one of the problems, though, today is we have been inundated with so much media and so many choices. We're able to, as you say, you know, pick and choose our confirmation bias and our worldview. It's like, well, I really like that, so it becomes self-reinforcing. Well, and how do you get out of that little cycle of, you know, reinforcing just you're hearing one side all the time?
Well, even as there's been, at least there was in the last couple of decades, a emphasis on, you know, math and statistics and the STEM and the core principles. Just because you produce a study or a scientific study doesn't mean that it's a valid study.
Right.
Or that...
Classic example, climate change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have people on both sides of that argument, you know, driving their stake in the ground and not willing to budge.
Or taking two valid sets of data and combining them in such a way that doesn't make sense. The classic example I use in my class is if you have one study that says that 90% of boating accidents happen in August and 90% of all the ice cream consumed in the country is consumed in August, then obviously ice cream contributes to boating accidents. You know, there's a lot of that goes on where people go, wait a minute, these two things.
Right. Correlation does not mean
exactly.
causation.
But you don't want to say that because they'll forget that saying. But if you can come up with a lively example and then show them some examples, they'll go, wait a minute, do these two things, one of these things is not like the other from
right.
Sesame Street, and do they necessarily belong in that set of
right. Yeah, that's a classical statistics, you know, and again, education is so important here in higher education, statistics and everything. Most programs have research in our area, and that is a core fundamental teaching that we do.
On some of the links that I ask you to share with them, just real quickly, if you're getting yourself set up to try to teach this, a couple ideas I think are real easy to get to and helpful. You know, one starts with Aristotle, the classic ethos, pathos, logos way of looking at an argument. And so what it does is I ask my students, when you listen to an argument by a speaker or a writer or whomever, ethos, what is the credibility of the speaker? Are they experts on it? Michael Jordan used to do ads for Hanes underwear. Why was he an expert in underwear? Did he have a degree in fashion merchandising?
Yeah,
I don't think so.
That's the rise of celebrity and advertising.
And then there's pathos, which is, you know, going back to Michael Jordan, that's misapplication of his ethos. He knows how to talk about basketball. I'm not sure what his qualifications are in other areas. You know, pathos is, are they appealing to you on a logical or emotional thing? You know, I always say, think of Hitler screaming, you know, getting people all fired up. That's not why you should be believing something. And then logos, Aristotle would have argued, that's logic. Does it make sense? Does the data fit in the right category to be able to so if you can get them to start thinking in those ways, what is the speaker or the communicator, which of these is he using? And people I agree with, I find them using pathos sometimes, and I got to ignore that. I'm trying to, as what they say makes sense. So that's kind of the foundation. And then also, I think we're linking to an article that has 7 traits that propagandists often use. And so I will, in one of my classes, I gave them a speech, an excerpt from Bernie Sanders and an excerpt from Donald Trump's speeches, their political speeches. And I say, which of these propaganda techniques, which a lot of people use, doesn't make you a bad person. It just means your argument needs to be investigated more. Are they using? And so that's an example of how I'm staying politically neutral. Pick either one of these that you want to listen to and figure out which techniques, because if you can get them stuck in your students' minds, they start applying them as they listen to advertising, as they start reading, even
right.
if they listen to your principal or you as a teacher.
Yeah, well, that's that critical thinking part, or more importantly, thinking, because we are such a society of consumers anymore, and we're just bombarded by advertising, and advertisers are you know, masters at manipulating. I mean, that's kind of the purpose, is to get you to want to buy their products. So they've had years and years and years of practice and refinement, and then combine that with the mass technologies and the social media. We, you know, this is really the first time we've really confronted this as a society with the power and the distribution mechanisms. You know, Twitter, prime example, one tweet away that just goes viral.
It's the power of technology and distribution. And if you take those two things, I think in two class periods, you know, teach a little bit and then have them take some media product and digest it, mm-hmm. rip it apart, dissect it. I think you can teach a lot in a very short time. Now, obviously, you want to come back to it in other units and magnify it, but I think it's something you got to start early on and then come back to and whatever you're teaching. If you're teaching something from history, then you can give them a historical speech and say, well, how was Abraham Lincoln? What was he trying to do with the Gettysburg Address? What was its rhetorical purpose?
I think back to my education. We had debates in middle school. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great time, you know.
Critical thinking.
And, you know, we had a section called In the News, and you know, we would, and that's part of authenticity and learning. You know, students are interested in what's happening in the world, you know, right now. So take advantage of that curiosity and then provide some of those opportunities. And, you know, we even had like mock trials and things like that, those situational or, you know, kind of case studies out there just to make it more real for the students. I mean, I can tell you exactly the items in the news today, and that's been many, many years ago.
You know, I did high school forensics. I had high school debate. And I can still tell you the question that I argued for a year when I was a sophomore, because I know that topic to this day really well, and I continue to be thoughtful of it and read articles I probably wouldn't otherwise read. So this is really a great chance for educators to plant some seeds that will sprout much later. When I literally say it will make the country better if you can make people smarter. You're not trying to get people to agree with you or disagree. You're just getting them to think and come up with whatever opinions may come, because that's the basic idea of our democracy.
Absolutely. First Amendment, you know, benefits out there and making that argument. And as I say, just a little bit of thinking and critical, you know, that critical review out there. Because as I said, we just got so much coming at us all the time. Now, like I said, we have three or four links, and we'll provide these in the show notes. The first one that we kind of started off with, I do want to mention, so if you're interested as a teacher, because this directly mm-hmm. applies for students, was an article called Students Have Dismaying Inability to Tell Fake News from Real, Study Finds.
And that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, that's for our audience of educators, K-12 in particular, but you know, higher education certainly mm-hmm. certainly as well. This provides just kind of an overview of some of those resources and things. And then, you know, the other thing in academia that we are often criticized, you know, living in the little crystal tower and everything, the ivory tower, I guess, philosophy matters. And it's something that's very difficult to instill in young people, because I just don't think they're ready. They don't have the life experience. But I find, certainly as I've become older, and realizing, you know, just studying the great masters and, you know, the philosophers over time, it's really, really fascinating. And there's, we kind of, again, in education, in K-12, we've always struggled with, you know, is the content important, or is it, you know, the constructivism and the building, you know, the building of knowledge? Those are kind of the behaviorism, I guess, versus constructivism is kind of the the big struggle going on. And honestly, you have to have both. You know, it's not one that's any better. And as good teachers, we mix that up. But we have to be able to demonstrate, you know, observable content, but at the same time, be able to take that base knowledge and then construct new meaning upon it.
Being smart is being smart. And what I mean by that is, so you spend 90% of your time thinking about how to prepare teachers to be better teachers. I spend 90% of my time teaching students how to be better journalists or photojournalists. You're teaching over there, I'm teaching over here. But in Journalism and Democracy, within 4 weeks, we're talking about constructivism. These core ideas about examining self and how self thinks and how others think and how you relate to those other people, that's what, to me, it means to be intelligent. You do need all this other stuff, but if you don't have the ability for self-examination and self-doubt and self-criticism,
in education.
I'm going to defend to my death your right to vote, but boy, I wish you wouldn't vote if you didn't do those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In education, it's that reflection piece that is that final piece that internalizes things, and it makes you critically self-examine, you know, some of that content. And that's when, you know, we use the term make it stick. That's when whenever the memories stick and become real and you, you know, it's not just, you know, learn something this week and take a test on Friday and you're done with it. You know, you just mentioned your experience there, you know, with the forensics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, many, many years ago. I won't give away how many years ago, but
a long
sophomore time. Isn't that amazing?
1980.
Yeah. So after all these years, that was a fundamental, I guess, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Fundamental development, I guess, or
yeah, or tenet in your character, in your life, that critical self-examination. To those people who teaching debate and forensics and critical thought, my hat's off, because the things I learned back then I still use almost every single day.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, the self-reflective thinking and things like that. I'm a huge fan of going out and using drawings. You know, pictures make a thousand words. Mind maps, you know, webs and things like that. And for me as a teacher, having my students do that, say do a mind map, start with a central concept and just have the students branch off and say, okay, tell me everything that you know. That's an excellent, quick, and easy way to kind of see the base knowledge and where the holes, the gaps are at. And it helps the student recognize, oh, well, I do have a deficiency in this area or something like that.
I actually remember doing that exercise in fourth grade. I didn't know it was a mind map. What I liked about my teacher was then, you know, your map kind of dies and she goes, well, don't you know about this? She would remind you of something you know, and you're like, oh, you draw a little bit in it, and it would remind you that you know a little bit more. But then I still remember this. She would say, as you become smarter and better educated and your tree gets bigger, all it really teaches you is there's a whole lot more that you don't know. And she said, to this day, I remember this. All a smart person realizes as they get smarter how much more they don't know.
Yeah.
And if you're willing to embrace the fact that you're going to be ignorant about more and more things as you realize other things exist, mm-hmm. you're going to be a happy person. Mm-hmm. If that makes you unhappy, you're going to be a closed down person.
Mm-hmm.
That was something someone said to me in fourth grade, and I can still kind of remember that as this permission to A, admit ignorance, but B, question those things you believe that you don't think you're ignorant on. And that's what a good education does fundamentally, mm-hmm. is teaches you how to ask great questions. And you have to be critical of fake news and all the information you're digesting if you're going to get anywhere close to this idyllic place of being a smart person.
Right. And, you know, going back to educational theory, back in the 30s, Vygotsky, a Russian psychologist, proposed the zone of proximal development, where one of the ways that we humans learn is you want to make the topic just out of grasp of somebody, but then tie the social emotional piece together, and together, you know, you can stretch and build. If you're not grasping out there to see how far, you know, your reach will go, you're never going to improve. And then once you improve, you can reach a little bit further, and that's how we become competent in, you know, in any subject area.
And in journalism class last week, I was saying my job is to make you perfect, realizing that you're never going to get there, mm-hmm. but my job is to get you halfway closer, and then halfway closer, and then halfway closer. Just realize you're never going to get there. So again, here we are in two kind of different places, but the commonality is these core ideas of what makes person a smart in a topic area, and that is willing to realize you're never going to master it, but you can't be happy sitting where you are, and that means questioning everything you digest related to that and
right.
related to your rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's a big deal, and I think sometimes we lose sight of what a big deal is because it just sounds like a cliche.
Mm-hmm. And then, like I say, we kind of get academic with it and talk about all the philosophies and things out there, but it really is so important. And when we become locked in our worldview, as so many of us are, and everybody's biased, we all have our biases out there. But whenever we're locked within that, as I said, that self-reinforcing loop out there, we just can't break out. That's why, like on Twitter and Facebook and things like that, that I follow people that I vehemently disagree with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I do that on purpose because I like to see, and every now and then it's like, oh, well, that's a very good point. And it will, you know, alter your perceptions out there. But that's that critical review out there as well.
And I think going back quickly, just going back to those articles, I think I, as a teacher, sometimes struggle to teach these big concepts. So I have to figure out what are the little exercises that get me closer to getting there. And in journalism, we teach when you write a story, you need to tell me who, what, when, where, why, and how. But I say the most important question to ask in a news story or in any situation is the why question. Why did that happen? Why did that person say that? Why does that person trying to motivate me to do that action? So as a teacher, just say to your students, always make sure you're asking the why.
Yeah.
The plane crashed. Why did the plane crash?
Yeah, that's another great mind map exercise, who, what, when, where, why. Just put those circles out there on whatever subject area it is and start filling out those little bubbles and answer each one of those questions. And I believe it was a journalist, I can't remember who it was. Was it Kipling that came up with that little poem about who, what, when, where, why, now, or whatever?
It's been attributed to him, and of course we're journalists, so we debate who actually said it. But yeah. It's like, go west, young man.
Well, I remember
that's not a Horace Greeley saying.
We
give it to him.
Yeah, I was taught that in middle school in English. Going through was just a way to develop papers and things like that. So these are fundamental things, and I need to stress too that fake news is nothing new. It's been around thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And
I'm going to interrupt you, but you nailed it when you talked about the technology and the ability of
that's what's
people
different.
Trying to modify our behaviors, advertisers, politicians, well-meaning people, bad-meaning people.
Well, Facebook being in the news and the absolute power with a billion plus, or like maybe 2 billion now, users. 2 billion of the world's population, getting very close to that, the immense power that platform has, and that's why they're under scrutiny right now, and Congress is going through the hearings and things. But it's we're at such a scalable world where you can go out, and as I said, as something goes viral, and that just fascinates me, what goes viral, because some of the most insane things go viral, and then yet we have people that I follow that are just brilliant, and here's this idea that really needs to spread, but it never gets a second look.
Because they're bad at marketing, and marketing
that's advertising
and should not rule opinion.
That's a huge issue. One of the things I always like to do in the summer, and I did this last summer, I might have mentioned it before on one of our podcasts, but I like, I'm going back through my memories of how I learned and the critical thinking and things that have developed over time. But one of the books that has had a big impact, and I can't remember what year it was written, but Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. Mm-hmm. And it takes, again, this is the worldview, but he basically is arguing two worldviews. Back, 1984, where we live in this dystopian society where government's surveilling us and all of that, and that's what's, going to, be the ruin of the world. Versus Adolf Huxley's A Brave New World, where that's where the title gets its name, Amusing Ourselves to Death, where we're just going to seek pleasure, which is kind of what we're doing in a worldview of where I'm only going to watch this news channel and completely tune out all other views and things. And we just kind of self-reinforce that pleasure. And when things are a click away or a tweet away, website, it's just so instantaneous. And that's where companies like Facebook have a tremendous responsibility out there. What's going on? Literally, the title of this is fake news, and why it's in the news. Then we end up with bots. Things go out there that replicate and try making these things, and they essentially build up a fake, consensus out there of nothing but machine learning algorithms. And that's something again that's a bit scary that we've not faced at that scale.
There, one of the philosophers that I use a lot in my classes is a guy named John Stuart Mill, and I'm using his essay called On Liberty. And one of the examples he talks about is the concept of the devil's advocate. So he was not necessarily a fan of organized religion or the Catholic Church, but he said even in the Catholic Church, when you are going to give someone the title of saint, they have a trial. You have to prove the person who is the advocate for the saint has to prove that they did these three miracles. But they also appoint one of their most learned, best able to argue appoint bishops or whatever to argue against the canonization of that person. And they are called the advocate for the devil or the devil's advocate. So he's pointing out even in the Catholic Church, you argue that this person isn't unworthy. You have a trial. Mm-hmm. And so going back to what you're saying, I think one of the best things you can teach a student to do is read something they disagree with and not to react with pathos, which is emotion, but go through that person's argument and then knock it down. That's the best way you defeat a argument you disagree with, is you go through it point by point and knock it down. Or if you're going to be in the debate, anticipate what the other side is going to say and then figure out why they're wrong.
Yeah.
And occasionally, smart people go, oh, I don't have a monopoly on wisdom. I have some of this wrong. Or you even change your opinion. But getting so the long point I'm getting to is, ask your students to take something you suspect they're going to disagree with, but teach them not to react in an emotional way, but go back to Aristotle and say, logically, how do you defeat this argument? That is critical thinking.
Yeah. Another great book I've read in the last 2 or 3 years is a book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Kahneman. And it's exactly that. You know, we react with a gut reaction, our emotions. We just sometimes we think, well, I know it in my gut, you know, and we've all had that experience out there. But then the slow part, it's our, you know, our logic and things, it's behind that.
It's the why. Why are you reacting? And if you can't define a logical reason why, there's the why question, you're reacting, then you're not entitled to that opinion. That's what Mill said. Just because you feel something doesn't mean you get to be right.
Or exactly. You make an emotional response. And again, we've all been there on the spur of a moment where we react to something without thinking about it. I mean, that's just, again, a human nature type thing that can often get us into trouble.
The discipline you often show when I'm wrong, but you're civil enough to say, no, Brian, here's why you're wrong.
And that's what we sorely lack in society today, because we're just yelling at each other, you know, without trying to.
No, we're not.
Yes, we are. So without trying to do that understanding part. And again, as educators, I just think that's important for us to model that in a school environment. So we do have several resources out there. I'll be sure to put those in the show notes. One of the things I like to do is I listen to a lot of audiobooks, so that Amusing Ourselves to Death is available in audio. Here at our Eastern Library, we have Media Mall, so it's, you know, we can check it out for free. And then that Thinking Fast and Slow, I don't know if it's available in audio or not, but it's an excellent read for educators and things out there if you're interested, you know, in providing some of these opportunities for your students and to get that critical thinking piece back in there. So thank you very much.
No problem.
My technology pick of the week this week, it's April 30th, 2018, the last day of the month, and it's time for Microsoft to release their April update.
Hooray.
This is something that's been overdue. They did get it on the April timeframe, but tomorrow's May, so they just barely squeaked by. But this is one that I've not had a lot of insider preview or anything on, but I've been following along on various blog posts and Windows insiders that I follow with. So I'm really curious. I haven't had any hands-on time, so if things go all right a little bit later today, and if the servers are available, I might go ahead and update my Surface Pro to satisfy my curiosity. Some things that I'm looking forward to, they're building in dictation into Windows 10, and there's a Windows shortcut key. The Windows key and the letter H will take you into that in any field. You just start talking and, you know, it dictates. And the dictation has gotten so much better over the years. And I find myself using that. I've got the dictation add-in in Microsoft Word, so that's a big improvement. They're adding something called Timeline. Since we're a multi-device, you know, switching from our phone to our computer to, you know, a laptop, so they've got some Timeline features that'll let you seamlessly change, you know, as you change device to pick up where you left off. They've added some Bluetooth capabilities, something called NearShare or something like that, but similar to Apple's AirDrop. For, you know, device-to-device sharing of various things. And then the other thing that I'm most curious about is the mixed reality. They're adding some features out there. I've got the VR goggles, and they're adding another. Right now in Windows 10, we have something called the Cliff House, which is like an operating system environment where you move from room to room and you access things. They're adding a new one. I think it's called Skyloft. So I'm interested in exploring that. And you know, just a lot of smaller updates and improvements and things. And usually, it's a little bit of a rocky rollout, as with anything when you know, when you're upgrading a billion computers. So I'm taking this on at my own risk. Normally I'd wait, but since it's my own device, I'll just back things up and hope for the best.
I'm sort of surprised because with this dictation thing, etc., it'll allow the government to keep track of you that much easier.
So. Well, that's another topic. You're going back to 1984 and dystopia again, so.
You worry about that more than I do, and I worry about hackers more than he does, so I'm just making fun of him.
Yeah. So that's my tech pick.
My tech pick is a little bit more hardware based, I guess. I'm a big fan of battery cases for whatever smartphone you have, but I like the battery cases that have a battery built into them, so you're getting both protection and, you know, another day or two of full power. Because toward the end of the day, sometimes I'm just not at home, and I'm like, oh, and I got some things to do. I use OneNote on my phone, and I check grades, and
yeah, it's becoming, you know, it's a computer.
Other entertaining myself to death type things. But the one that I found that I like, and I mostly use iPhones, is made by Tranium, Trianium. And I got it on Amazon, and there's a bunch of them, and I've used it on the iPhone 6 and 7 and current model 8, and they're anywhere from like $20 to $38, and it's one of my favorite things to have, because first of all, I find the iPhone a little too slippery and small, actually. Mm-hmm. But I can now drop it and not worry about it breaking 99% of the time.
Do you find that the iPhone? I'm using an Android phone, and I'm using an S7 right now, a Galaxy S7. I've not really had any battery issues without. Does the iPhone use a little bit more juice, or is it because you're using it maybe more? I don't use mine.
I find it's a little better than it used to be. I just get really nervous that at the time I'm going to use it. And I also, you know, we talked about previously, I stick it on my bike and use the GPS, and I'm having it sending signals and all that sort of stuff.
Might help with my crack case, too.
Yeah.
Oh, crack it again on the microphone.
Yeah, he was telling me how he was putting fences in yesterday and lost his phone in the middle of a field, so that doesn't surprise me.
But I found
it. The other thing this case does is it converts from a lightning port to a USB. So
that's nice.
It gets me out of the lightning universe, and so I can just use it more standard. And so
can you do both?
And it still syncs. Yeah, it still syncs and syncs and does the data transfer and that sort of thing. Now it does take away the wireless charging, but I'm not a wireless charging fan.
Yeah. Now, you're also a photojournalist, and you're using an iPhone and things, and I'm just curious, because this little critical thinking exercise and fake news and things certainly has a lot to do with images.
One, if you put in fake news, and I don't know if it's it might have been one of the articles we linked to, students were shown this photo that was doctored to make these daisies look like they were strange new plant or something, and students didn't even question it. They're like, oh, okay, wow, that's cool. There's a strange new double-headed daisy plant. They didn't look at the source. So, I know you've seen the video where it takes President Obama and they put different speech and different words into his mouth, and they video were able to modify his mouth, and you would never. Well, the new Star Wars movie where you have several dead actors that have been modified from previous live.
Yeah.
Shots to make it look like they're still in the movie. There's two or three of them, I believe, in the
The virtual reality industry has gotten just so perfect at it that even for a trained eye, I think if you did an AB blind test, you might be 50-50 on a lot of this. So it's that context out there.
Well, they can even put digital artifacts into stuff they create to make it look like it's a rough film or from 1940 and all that sort of stuff. So it doesn't even look too clean. They know exactly how to fool your brain.
Yeah, and then the next evolution to this mixed reality with these goggles and things that I'm exploring is, overlaying like your hand with a glove or, something like that for a game that it just tricks your mind completely.
And then there's that with that technology, you have that classic battle of entertaining yourself to death. I mean, are you going too far to the entertainment versus the education? But we've raised this expectation because of all the media we allow our children to be exposed to, and we have to build in a certain amount of entertainment factor to keep interest. I mean, that's always been part of it. Do you draw that line?
Yeah, and I think another thing, going back, like I said, kind of reviewing things that I've watched before, and with the passage of time, watching again, I've not watched The Matrix in a long, long time. A red pill or blue pill type question out there. I think that would be, with all this fake news and everything out there, I think that would be interesting to.
And there's a whole constructivism thing you can go off just on that for an hour.
Oh, yeah. So there's always, you know, plenty to talk with. But I think we do need to provide our students with these opportunities and things. And, you know, technology is certainly not going to go away. And there's a lot of unintended consequences along the way. So kind of got off track there a little bit, tying back to our fake news, but we've got our technology picks of the week, so we'll leave it there. That wraps it up for episode 211 of Tech Talk for Teachers. Show notes for this episode and previous episodes are available on the web at the EIU Instructional Technology Center website at eiu.edu/ITC. Just click on the Tech Talk for Teachers link. Until next time, this is Tom Grissom.
This is Brian Poulter.
Keep on learning.